It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll check out the first Wisconsin screening of a new documentary on the lives of actors and civil rights activists Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis. The director, their grandson, joins the show.
First, we're listening to Go to the Mardi Gras by Professor Longhair, and today the city of New Orleans is celebrating Mardi Gras.
New Orleans is the birthplace of jazz music. Here to talk about jazz and the music of New Orleans is Richard Davis, music professor at UW-Madison and world-renowned jazz bassist. Davis has been part of more than 3,000 recordings. He's worked with everyone, musical icons ranging from Miles Davis to Bruce Springsteen. Richard, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So, New Orleans, the birthplace of jazz, was it the key place? Is that really where jazz was born?
Yes.
And how did it come to pass? How did New Orleans play such a pivotal role in the development of this American musical genre?
Well, it just happens that the musicians who classified and dignified their music with their talents were in New Orleans.
And what do you think, when you think of the quintessential New Orleans jazz sound, what do you think of today? Who do we need to tip our hats to?
When I think of who?
When you think of the quintessential New Orleans jazz sound, who comes to mind for you?
Oh, well, we have musicians who are in their 30s, 40s, and even 20s who are keeping the tradition going. Comes to mind right away is Wynton Marsalis, who is from New Orleans. And he dedicates a lot of his time and efforts to keeping that tradition in front of the audience by playing it, playing a New Orleans style. He can play like a trumpet player was playing in 1920s.
Now, when a lot of us think of New Orleans music, we think of Louis Armstrong. I'm going to give a listen to his classic, When the Saints Go Marching In.
Oh, when the Saints, when the Saints go marching in,
marching in.
Now, when the Saints go marching in,
marching in.
Yes, I want to be in that number when the Saints go marching in.
So, Louis Armstrong, can you talk about his role, Richard, in the development of New Orleans music, of jazz in general?
Well, he is the big daddy of jazz. The person who started playing jazz was also a trumpet player named Buddy Bolden. But we don't have any references to him because he never made any recordings. But he was a news editor, a barber, and a person who was given credit to play the first note, which was considered jazz style. Louis Armstrong is the one who was recorded a lot in the 20s, and people, when they think of jazz, you can't help but think of Louis Armstrong because he's the man. He's the one that started the rhythmic phrases of how jazz goes, and you look at a list of the players today, and they're still using all of what he was doing to play their music the way he played it. It's funny you mentioned you put on When the Saints Go Marching In.
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yep. Yeah, When the Saints Go Marching In. Why is it funny that we mentioned that particular one?
Because I was going to tell you to play it.
well done.
I had a couple of other items from the Mardi Gras, but go ahead with your questions.
Well, I want to talk about another musician that I've heard that you think really highly of, Dr. John, that we can't really think about New Orleans music without mentioning him. What is it about Dr. John that speaks to you?
Well, he has that flavor in his performances, and he's demonstrates it very simply and very easily. Along with other jazz musicians in New Orleans who do that. Are you thinking about Neville Brothers? You know the Neville Brothers?
Mm-hmm. Right.
They're from New Orleans. And I can tell when I'm playing with a certain drummer whether he has New Orleans in his veins or not.
How can you tell?
It's a style that only them have. It just comes from... It's all like colloquialisms, and they play that style. Eddie Blackwell was one of the musicians who I worked with years ago who had that style, and you could tell it as soon as you hear him play. They have that background. It's almost like saying, if you're from Chicago, you have a certain accent. New York, certain accent. California, certain accent. And the audience, when it comes to performance, especially in the rhythm section, you can hear it announced in the way the guy plays.
Well, we mentioned Dr. John. Let's give a little listen to Dr. John here.
Mama Ruth, she was the queen of the little red, white, and blue.
Mama Ruth,
she was the queen of the little red, white, and blue. Said, ooh, why?
So Richard Davis, do you hear the New Orleans accent in the, well, the singer, I think, yeah, but in the rhythm section, too?
I hear it all over the place. It's hard to define it. Are you a musician?
Amateur, yeah.
It's difficult for me to define it to you as a non-musician, but when you're playing with the musician, as I have in many occasions, you can feel it when they play. Have you heard the song Fire of the Bayou?
Oh, sure, yeah. I have heard a couple. That's a pretty commonly covered one, right?
Yeah. And then there's also called Mardi Gras Mambo.
And I want to ask you about the bass in particular, because you play the bass. What role do you think that bass sound plays in New Orleans jazz?
Well, it plays quite a bit, because some of the old players on the bass demonstrated their performances with a certain style, maybe called slap bass, two-beat bass, or bass that was simplified, like the tuba. Most bass players in that day and time were people who really played the tuba. And when they converted to the sound that Louis Armstrong started, a smoother cushion sound, the string bass had more of a buoyancy about it. And that's why the banjo was replaced by the guitar. The banjo was very percussive, and the guitar was more resonant. Matter of fact, I just left New Orleans last week.
Yeah?
And I realized where that song so popular by Louis Armstrong was named after a street right around the corner from where I was staying.
Hmm.
And my mother's from New Orleans. She took me down there when I was about 3, and I saw the Mardi Gras, and I felt the fervor of the people in the street. I never will forget it. As young as I was, I felt something was very... celebrated.
Did you play on this last trip to New Orleans? Did you have some shows down there?
I went to visit my girlfriend who is staying down there for the winter. Matter of fact, I told her I would hook her up to this phone call, but I forgot.
All right, we'll leave it there. Richard Davis, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Richard Davis, a music professor, bass player at UW-Madison, world-renowned jazz bassist. Tonight, UW Parkside hosts the Midwest debut of a new documentary telling the story of two legendary actors and civil rights activists.
Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis had acting careers spanning from the 1950s to Spike Lee movies in the 80s and 90s. They were credited with opening the door to African-American actors playing a wider variety of non-stereotypical roles. They acted on stage, they wrote and directed movies, and they were active in the civil rights movement.
Davis passed away about 10 years ago, and Ruby Dee last July. But before she passed away, their grandson, film producer Muta Ali Muhammad, sat down with her for a series of interviews. He shares those interviews and her story in his new documentary, Life's Essentials with Ruby Dee. The Mahone Foundation and UW Parkside are screening that documentary tonight at 7 at the UW Parkside Cinema. Muta Ali is in Wisconsin for that event. Muta Ali Muhammad, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, you have clips of a number of actors and others, people like Danny Glover, Spike Lee, Angela Bassett, Alan Alda, and it seems like they all came back to a common message, something along the lines of, we need to hear the story of Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis. Why do we need to hear their story?
Oh, well, they stood for a lot of great things. And in the documentary, you can see their principles of love, art, and activism really shine. And everyone who you see, from Alan Alda to Spike Lee, as you mentioned, they came and were a part of this film because they love Grandpa and Grand Ruby. They love what they stood for. And you can learn from them in terms of love, because they were married for over 56 years, a Hollywood marriage, 56 years plus. And that's unusual. You can learn when it comes to their art, because as human beings, they were very conscious of what roles they decided to take and not take, because they didn't want to be part of any work of art that did a disservice to the community. And you can learn from them in terms of their decisions as citizens, in terms of their activism. They were activists throughout all of their adult lives, and it's fascinating how they were able to do so much in the time they had on this earth.
We'll dig into more of those essentials in a minute, but this is a personal story for you, too. What led you to sit down with your grandmother and film these interviews with her?
Well, you know, it was the loss of my grandfather. When he passed away, I was in my mid to late 20s, and I really felt that I missed the opportunity to sit and deliberately speak with him about his values and pick his brain about how to approach life and how to be a great person. And not only the pain of losing someone I love, but the pain of losing someone who is a genius in so many ways, and regretting not having sat down and spoke with him deliberately. I didn't want to repeat that. And my grandmother was a genius in her own right, and she was a loving grandmother and a loving wife to my grandfather. So I said, you know what? I have this opportunity to sit there and speak with her, and maybe as I learn about how she accomplished so much, anyone watching the documentary could maybe learn a thing or two, or just experience her if they've never met her.
Well, let's meet her, hear her voice a little bit. A couple of clips together here from your conversations with her.
This is my first interview by one of my grandchildren, and I'm nervous. Our marriage was a whole lot of learning and talking and discussion and a little fighting in there too, you know, and discovering things about where and how we live, and becoming writers together. It was the most magical experience for me in my life.
So much there. Let's start with that first essential that you mentioned earlier, love. This was, as you said, a five-decade marriage, not really the norm for what you think of as a Hollywood actor. What did you learn from your grandmother, Ruby Dee, about love and marriage?
I learned that, and when it comes to commitment, because that's a lot of what I asked her about, being faithful and committed for so long when there's so many distractions on this earth. She first told me that it was a decision. When you stick to your decision when it comes to loving somebody, the responsibility, she calls it, of loving somebody, then that can give you longevity. She also said forgiveness. Forgiveness is a really, really big part of having a long lasting relationship. And I asked her various serious questions. A lot of people, when they watch the film, they feel like they're part of a conversation that they should not be part of, because it's so intimate and honest. But she gave some great advice to me about love, and I'm going to heed that advice.
And you mentioned they turned down roles that might take them too far from each other, or that didn't meet their standards for what they wanted to see on a screen. How hard was that? I mean, you think an actor, you want to take the roles that you have a shot at getting.
Yeah, it was very hard, you know, and they had a family to support, too. So some of the decisions that they made, like to not go further on tour with certain projects, or not go, Grandma Ruby had opportunities to do a lot of plays over in Europe. She wanted to stay and raise her children. So their principles kind of outshined or took precedence over their desire to have more money in their bank account. And watching that and listening to archival audio tapes, I had a tape of my grandmother talking with my grandfather candidly about how she was not going to take on this gig. It was an advertisement. She was going to advertise for this car, a major car dealer. And she refused to do it because she said, you know, I'm not going to sit here and promote vanity and materialism. And I heard it on tape. I'm like, this is in the 70s. I'm like, that's pretty huge, because if anybody came to me wanted to put me in an ad for a major car, I'd jump at the chance. But thinking of materialism above my own welfare as an artist and as a person with a family, that's a huge, brave step to make, and it's inspiring to see that.
Your grandparents are often credited with breaking new ground for African-American actors. Roles previously, I guess, had often been for, you know, a comic relief servant, often very stereotypical. How did they break those stereotypes and give a more human range for African-American actors?
I think their character, Grandma Ruby, she grew up in Harlem, and she witnessed a lot of what happens when people have the wrong idea about others and different prejudices, and people are being able to get unable to get jobs. And Grandpa grew up in the deep south of Georgia, and being around that, I think they had an understanding of what's at stake when you portray negative characters on TV and how it can misinform people about the humanity of all of us, of all colors. So I think by working hard, they were able to survive even through being blacklisted at times through for different reasons in terms of their political beliefs or their political friends. They were able to survive by performing in churches and at schools and for the local community. The community around the country really supports and loves Ossie and Ruby, and that's what allowed them to turn down a role that they otherwise would have been forced to accept.
Now, they were actors and did a lot of other things related to writing, performing, directing, things like that. But they also, it seems like, always saw themselves as activists in the civil rights era and up almost to the end of their lives. Why was that so important for them?
Well, you know, to me, and even in different ways they say it, they're very passionate people. And I think their love, just the love that they exude and the love that they have for this earth around us, was the foundation for it. And their love for each other, it expanded. You know, to be in love with someone for decades and decades requires you to have something inside you that's sensitive to the world outside of you. And with that, that allowed them to be sensitive to the needs of their community and the whole country. And when you are sensitive to the needs of people around you and you see injustice, you're compelled almost to take action. So even back when Paul Robeson was very active, they supported him all the way up through the civil rights movement and the Black Panthers and decades and decades of activism. And that came from their ability to love and to be sensitive yet powerful at the same time.
An amazing thing to me is that they're married to each other, but they do all the same stuff. They're in the same line of work. They're in the same kinds of activism. It seems like they were constantly doing the same thing. Was that ever a source of tension for them, trying to separate out their activist lives, their actor lives, and their personal lives?
You know, I wondered that, too. I wondered if they kind of disagreed artistically sometimes, X, Y, and Z. But they had completely different styles. If you take a look at Graham Ruby's one-woman show, My One Good Nerve, it's completely different from Grandpa's play, Pearly Victorious. And I think they complemented each other well in terms of their working style. But also their activism, as they told me, brought them together. You know, the ups and downs of marriage, sometimes when you both have a common goal, even though you don't even want to speak to one another, having that common goal of addressing an injustice or addressing an issue, it brought them together. And that's some of the things that they told me over the years. So when you have a common goal with your partner, sometimes it overshadows any sort of disagreement you might be having.
I saw a clip, I think it was from Ruby Dee's 90th birthday party. She says something to the effect of, "I don't want to die because I'm old, I want to die fixing some of the," I'm paraphrasing, "stuff that's wrong with the world." Did she keep working on that stuff, her activism, right till the end?
Yeah, absolutely. We couldn't get her to stop moving. She's one of the toughest people I've ever met in my life. And when it comes to her art, she was working all the way up until she couldn't. And when it comes to her activism, every day, I was living with her during this project, every day there was something that she would be talking about or trying to help. And she had a great excitement for the youth, the young people who are coming up today, who are speaking up and making a change. She had excitement about young women who are making a change right now, and she wanted to know how she can help. How can I help? How can I help? She had this undying spirit that I will never, ever forget. And so that activism, it stayed with her until she couldn't, you know, do anything.
You're sharing her story in part to inspire other people, but interviewing her, talking to her, editing this all together, how were you inspired by this experience?
Well, man, I was inspired because watching her work so hard and watching how her spirit was the most powerful thing about her. Her spirit was more powerful than her physical ability, even as she grew older. Just being around her was very inspiring. Watching the community come behind this project, we're a Kickstarter project, so 394 people from around the world help us get our seed money, and a lot of the people who are in the film helped us get this thing done. Watching all of that and the love that everyone has for Grandpa and Grand Ruby, that was very, very inspiring. And then being able to go through the archive on my own and see the letters that she and Grandpa wrote to studio heads, the notes that they had to one another, the inner workings of two people who are great successes in love, art, and activism, it blows my mind how much I will forever be inspired by this process. And I encourage everyone to go through this process with their own family, because we all have very interesting and rich histories among us.
Muta Ali, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Muta Ali Muhammad. He's writer and director of Life's Essentials with Ruby Dee. UW Parkside and the Mahone Foundation are hosting a screening of that documentary. It's tonight at 7 at the UW Parkside Cinema near Kenosha. Today is primary election day in many municipalities around the state. Did you go out and vote? According to voter turnout numbers, historically speaking, odds are you won't get around to it.
Well, some would say that local government is the most pure form of democracy. It seems like a lot of us don't take advantage of the opportunity to participate in these nonpartisan elections.
Are we talking about you right now? If so, why don't you go out and vote in these local elections? Or if you always get out and vote, why do you think it's important? Have you ever run for local office, say city council, school board, mayor? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org.
Mordecai Lee joins us right now. He's a former state lawmaker and longtime political analyst, now a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee. Mordecai, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me, Veronica.
So it looks like, from some numbers we saw, that partisan elections get turnout about 70%. That's from 2012. But nonpartisan elections only see an average turnout of about 20%. Why is that?
Well, there are probably several reasons. I think perhaps the most important is that we talk about that there is something called a propensity to vote. And the political science literature has identified that there are three factors that are very predictable in terms of somebody's likelihood of voting, in other words, thinking it's important, and somebody thinking it's a casual thing and usually not voting. And generally speaking, what we're talking about is age, education, and income. And that the higher a person's age or education or income, the more likely they are to vote. And the lower their age or education or income, the less likely they are to vote. And so here we are on a primary day. There aren't any statewide primaries. For example, there's not a Supreme Court race. So there are only local races. In some municipalities and counties, there might not be primaries, even if there are elections. In other words, only two candidates filed. And so I guess it leads to exactly what we're talking about. But, Veronica, we probably ought to emphasize that anybody who's listening right now, it's not too late to vote, if we can talk you into it, that polls in Wisconsin generally close at 8 p.m., and you can register to vote at the polls. So anybody listening who were sort of triggering and piquing your interest, please use the next 3 hours well.
Well, in terms of voting for local officials like mayors, city council members, are we more directly connected to these people because they're at the local level? Is that fair to say?
I think that's a good comment. After all, it's part of American parlance that we talk about you can't fight City Hall, or we talk about the mayor this and the mayor that. In other words, it's very much part of our political DNA that local government feels close and local government touches us. After all, if the snow plowing last week was good or bad, we know who to talk to, we know who to complain to, or we know what our tax dollars are paying for, because it generally is the municipal level of government or the county level of government. And also, with lower population districts, in other words, let's say for a common council member of a city, we might be talking about 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 people. That's a relatively small district, so the odds are that one would know, or one would only be a couple of degrees separated from somebody who holds office. So You're right. We do think of local government as being close to us, but for some reason we don't follow through and vote in those elections.
Right. Well, that's an interesting question to tease out, why people don't feel connected in these elections. They don't get riled up and go and vote in them in numbers that are that large. And considering that they can wield more influence in an election where fewer people vote, so what do you think is going on? Is there something procedural that's not happening about why people aren't voting in these elections?
Well, I'd guess that there's some kind of sort of sexiness attached to elections, which probably strikes people as an odd pair. But Wisconsinites and Americans in general consider a presidential race a very sexy race. In other words, they know it's important, and it comes every 4 years. And I was glad, Veronica, that you mentioned that there are some fall elections that have a 70% turnout. That was the gubernatorial election just a couple of months ago. Or the presidential election in 2012, Wisconsin had one of the highest turnouts in the nation. So in other words, it's sexy to vote for president because we automatically know that it's important. And even when we have presidential primaries in, sometimes they're in April, they used to be briefly in February, there also was a bump in the turnout because people understood that participating in deciding who the nominee of each party would be for president was also important, and those tended to attract a lot of attention. But here we are in a non-presidential year where we don't have a presidential primary in the spring election. And generally speaking, sometimes incumbents for all offices in Wisconsin aren't challenged. In other words, today there would only be voting when there are more than two candidates running for that office. So put it all together and we've got a low turnout. I wouldn't be surprised, based on your introduction and Rob's comments, we might have single-digit turnout today.
Oh, so that's an interesting, single-digit turnout is pretty low. And you talked about some of the city services factors that go into these elections that are more at the core of what these elections are about, things like snow removal, trash removal, things that affect municipalities. Do you think that people feel that, you know, those things will be taken care of anyway, whether or not I vote? Whereas when you're playing sort of the high-stakes poker, when you're voting in a, say, presidential election, these are things that have a big impact. It's that wow factor you're talking about.
Well, I think you're putting your finger on it, and we can make a comparison between today, the primary for the nonpartisan election, and in April, which will be the general election of the nonpartisan election. In other words, that we sort of all intuitively understand the importance of a final round. In other words, this is it. This is the real thing. And it's really easy to make a comparison to football. After all, it's the Super Bowl that has the highest audience of the football season because everybody understands that it's important and it's become a kind of a party day where people get together. But then if you sort of work it backwards in terms of logic, well, if everybody's so interested in the Super Bowl, why aren't they interested in, let's say, the conference championship two Sundays before that? After all, it's the semifinal. It's important. The Packers played in it. But for some reason, we as Americans, we consider semifinals, in other words, like the equivalent of a primary election, as not important as that final showdown, the final election that makes a difference. And so I'm pretty sure that in April, for this election, even without any statewide races, we'll probably get to 20-25% turnout. That'll probably be double or triple or more what we have today.
Let's go to a caller now. We've got Susan on the line with us from Madison. Hi, Susan.
Hello. I am concerned that in various different communities that people do not even know that the election is happening or what offices are even going to be voted on, not only in the primary but frequently in the April election. They're more likely to know about the November election. And it seems that when people have panels and they invite the news media to come to the panel discussion and maybe a couple of the candidates will show up for a panel discussion and there will be different types of answers given, it's kind of a serious problem that it's very difficult to get the news media to come to it or to cover it so that people that aren't there and don't have schedules that can be at a panel thing could just quickly get summaries of what the differences were when they read it in the paper or maybe...
Got it. Thank you so much for your thoughts, Susan. And Susan's worried that people just aren't aware that the elections or primaries aren't happening at all. And also she's talking about the difficulty of getting the media out there so that, you know, what the candidates say can be out there for people to help inform their vote. What do you think about those two problems?
I think she's really nailed it in the sense of that everything is so passive about elections. You know, they unlock the door to the polling station and they expect people to come. This is not the equivalent of if you build it, they will come. I really think that we need forms of public outreach by government, public service advertising, mailings perhaps, that say, you know, don't forget next Tuesday is the election, and we've given every candidate 200 words that they can list what they believe in, and we're attaching this sort of nonpartisan document, and be sure to vote. If you have any questions, call us. You know, we do that. We just experienced doing that for the health care deadline. I think Susan is right. We ought to be doing things like that when it comes to elections.
Well, Susan, thanks a lot for the call, and we'll hear from more of you in just a bit. It's primary election day. We're talking with Mordecai Lee about why so many of us opt out of the nonpartisan local elections.
And we're turning that question out to you. What do you think it would take to boost that turnout? Single digits, maybe, for primaries in these nonpartisan elections? 20% range, 20 to 30% range for the general elections. What would get more people to the polls to vote for things like county boards, city council, school board, mayor, all those local elected officials? Do you vote every time or do you skip them? Have you run for one of these offices? Why? Why did you decide you wanted to get civically involved in that way? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We're talking with political analyst Mordecai Lee about why so few of us participate in local elections like those that are taking place today.
Have you ever run for local office? What did you do to try to get people out to the polls, to get them out there to support you? What do you think it would take to get more people to vote in these nonpartisan elections that we have, primaries in February, the runoff in April? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or you can post a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got a caller here from Janesville. Kevin is with us. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. My idea to increase voter turnout is to take the attendance roll from where I checked in to go vote. If I vote, I go to the bottom of the list for jury duty, and if I don't show up, I go to the top of the list.
That might do it. Kevin, thanks a lot for the idea. I don't know how that would go over, but Mordecai, what do you think? Creative thinking there.
No, it's a great idea in the principle that Kevin is enunciating. In other words, to create incentives to vote, even if they're relatively modest. After all, when we're called to jury duty, it doesn't happen all that frequently. But nonetheless, to create a kind of reward and punishment system. And in fact, in Australia, believe it or not, they go so far as giving people a fine if they don't vote. Now, it's not a lot of money, you know, this isn't fascism or anything like that, and it's really antithetical to American values, but that in other cultures, they view the importance of voting as requiring something along the line of what Kevin said or what Australians do, and that's for people to sort of get back in touch with the importance of voting.
Well, that's very interesting. So it sounds like there is a different attitude, say, in Australia about voting, weighted heavily towards civic duty. And I'm wondering why Americans don't feel that same weight. I mean, we're not penalized if we don't vote, but there also isn't that societal pressure to vote either.
You're really right. And I'm wondering if when we were talking about the difference in turnouts between the nonpartisan spring elections and the partisan fall elections, if maybe we're hinting at something, and that's that nonpartisan elections are sort of harder for the average voter in the sense of that generally speaking in most races, even nonpartisan races, there's one candidate who's right of center and there's one candidate who's left of center. For example, in the last 20 years, that happens in just about every state Supreme Court race. But you wouldn't know it because they're running in a nonpartisan election. Maybe having nonpartisan elections by definition is a bad idea because then it requires so much information by the voter to figure out who's right of center and who's left of center. You know, in Milwaukee, we used to elect mayors on a partisan ballot, and that's when we elected a socialist mayor in 1910. And believe it or not, the Republicans and Democrats in the state legislature decided that the way to cripple the socialists was by changing the state law so that Milwaukee mayors were elected on a nonpartisan basis. In other words, it would be harder to identify the socialist. Maybe we need to go back to partisan elections so that we have a Democratic nominee for mayor and a Republican nominee for mayor.
Interesting. All right, well, let's go back to the callers now. Eric joins us next from Endeavor. Hi, Eric.
Hello. You know, actually, I voted for the first time in 21 years recently in the last election. They always try to make you feel guilty for not voting. I actually felt really bad guilty for having voted.
Why did you feel guilty for having voted?
You know, I'm not sure. It was just this overwhelming sense of dread. Like, I really shouldn't have done that. But I'm not going to say who I voted for, because when I was a kid, people didn't tell people who they voted for. Now it's all they talk about, but...
So you haven't voted for 21 years because you felt it was something that you associated with negative emotions.
Pretty much. And then I'd never had negative emotions doing it before when I was younger. But now I voted recently, and I just woke up the next day feeling dreadful, like I shouldn't have done that. Now it is my fault.
You going to vote again?
It'll be a while.
All right, Eric, thanks. I don't know, Mordecai, do you have a read on that one, response?
I love that Eric used the word dread, and I think he's sort of capturing how Americans feel about elections, that we've lost the excitement of democracy and the power of democracy, and instead we view going to vote as like sort of going to the dentist, and I have nothing against dentists. Some of my best friends are dentists, but the dread of doing it, the feeling of guilt or of burden of an obligation to do it, that somebody's wagging their finger at us and saying, why didn't you vote? You should vote. I wish we could get back to how exciting it is to participate in democracy. And, you know, today is the perfect example, Veronica, because there are going to be some low turnout primaries where the number of people casting a vote for that office might be a couple hundred. It might decide, let's say in a township, who the final two nominees for town board might be decided by a couple hundred people casting votes. In other words, that the one who gets shaved off tonight might only have gotten a couple dozen votes. And so when you think about the excitement of the power of your vote, if there are only going to be a couple hundred votes cast, your vote can really make a difference. There can be a tie, or there can be a one-vote victory margin in such low-turnout elections.
Yeah, that's some excitement there. Any other ideas for getting more excitement back in democracy?
Well, I think that when Susan had called from Madison, she was indirectly pointing out that we sort of lost the civic structure of very active civic groups, League of Women Voters, many debates, neighborhood forums, neighborhood coffees, and especially I want to focus on sort of the minimal media attention. You know, I think American newspapers have always taken a very cautious attitude about covering political elections because they don't want to be viewed as tilting their coverage to, let's say, somebody who's right of center, somebody who's left of center. And that's made for really sterile coverage. And maybe what we need is that sort of more vigorous coverage, more of an MSNBC Fox News approach to covering local elections. And I think that would make more vivid the importance of the issues that candidates are differ upon.
Let's go back to our callers now. Daniel is with us next in Milwaukee. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, hello. I'd like to say thanks for the topic. I think it's a great topic, but I was just wondering if Mordecai would be willing to kind of comment on the idea of how it seems like that a vast majority of the people that do not turn out to vote on especially these smaller elections come from impoverished communities and whatnot, and it just seems like it's a lot harder when you're living paycheck to paycheck day to day and you can't miss that work, you know, for a smaller event like this to, you know, take the time off of work, even though we're supposed to get the time off, et cetera, et cetera.
Great point. Thanks, Daniel.
No, Daniel has really hit a bullseye here, and that today the people voting are going to be, generally speaking, elderly, generally speaking, college graduates, generally speaking, higher than average income. And the very people that Daniel is talking about, who are very much affected by local government services, have less of a propensity to vote because they're below average in education or income. And that if they participated, it would make a huge difference. And if we could just figure out the secret formula for getting them to vote, that'd be fabulous.
Do we need to, as Daniel suggested, need to make it easier to vote? You know, have employers make a concerted effort to get the word out to employees, you know, it's okay, go vote.
You know, there used to be a time when Election Day was like a vacation day. It was sort of like Labor Day. And also there was a time when on Election Day all the bars and taverns were closed, which sort of says something about America 100 years ago. But I think Daniel's right. If we could do more things to give people the time and interest to vote, then maybe it would increase the turnout.
And in terms of, you know, the way people feel about politics, going back to that excitement factor that you were talking about, do you think that, you know, what we're seeing in these low numbers, particularly in this nonpartisan election, does this reflect a greater sort of dissatisfaction, ennui, sort of with politics in America in general? Maybe we're just not feeling invested in politics because we don't believe in them anymore.
Well, Veronica, I think you're right that that's probably half the answer. In other words, that there are some non-voters who are alienated from politics and don't believe that it's relevant to them or that voting would make any change that would affect their lives. But on the other hand, you could argue it on the other half of it. You could say the fact that somebody chooses not to vote is an expression that they're content with the status quo and that they really don't care sort of who wins the election because they believe that, generally speaking, things will still be about the same. Regarding today, they'll still get decent police protection, decent fire protection, and so on. So it's probably half and half in that direction.
Well, just to play devil's advocate here, you know, given that the people who turn out at these elections seem to be more passionate because they're there voting, they're more educated, according to what you've said, are the rest of us better off having these people select the best candidates and let them advance to the general election for us?
You know, that's what actually happens. I'm not sure that we're better off. After all, everybody's vote can count, and everybody's vote can make a difference. And I really don't believe in sort of the aristocracy of voting or a class approach to voting, that there's an elite that will decide who the last two candidates are. Everybody can participate. And in a sense, American democracy is still an experiment. It's a faith in a dream, and I wish we could recapture what the founders actually decided.
And Mordecai, polls won't be closing for a couple hours yet. What do you say to people who haven't voted yet today and say they're unprepared to make the call?
What I'd suggest is just go on the Internet, take a quick look at the web pages of the candidates or local press coverage of the candidates or local blogs about those races. Decide who you more agree with or more disagree with. If you tend to be a right-of-center person or a left-of-center person, you'll probably be able to figure out who's who, because but you've got three more hours to vote, and you can make a difference. And if one of them survives the primary by one vote, it'll be your vote.
Mordecai, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Veronica.
That was Mordecai Lee, former state lawmaker and professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee.